Brilliant. Welcome to the Education Employers Task Force and to this November seminar in our series of free seminars on the subject of school to work transitions and employer engagement in the education. The seminar series is co-sponsored by the Centre for Education Industry at the University of Warwick. Today our speaker is Nancy Hoffman. Nancy, over a number of years, has established herself as one of the leading thinkers in the world about the subject of school to work transitions. In her work with the Boston not-for-profit Jobs for the Future, in her work with the OECD, particularly as a key author of the 2010 report, Learning for Jobs, which I heartily recommend, and perhaps most recently, as author of Schooling in the Workplace, which is a really good overview of international practice in supporting young people from education into work. And currently, working with colleagues at Harvard University in taking forward the Pathways to Prosperity project, which is putting sort of theory into action across a number of American states. So we're delighted to have Nancy here today. And Nancy, I'll hand over to you now.
Thank you very much, Anthony. And thank you, James. It's nice to see both of you again. So here's what I think will be useful. You're not going to get a lot of solutions from the United States. You're going to get a view of how we're solving some problems that I think are rather similar to the ones that you're facing in the UK. I know a lot about international vocational education systems, and we can talk some about them, but neither of our countries are exactly on the leading edge. And so rather than make you green with envy about Switzerland, where 75% of students are in the VET system and they have a 3% youth unemployment rate, I think we should probably just talk about the struggle we're both involved in and how this is all moving forward in the United States. So let me just start with a little short history. We David Harborn and I had breakfast this morning with some colleagues, and I was just talking a little bit about the history in the U.S., which, while it's not exactly the same as here, the sort of trial and error about doing a better job making the transition from school to work actually smooth and make it serve a wide range of kids, I think you've been struggling with too. And so when I look back, in the U.S., starting when I first started even thinking about this issue, it was the 1960s, and I think we thought about it both at the federal level and the state level for every decade until the beginning of the middle of the 90s, when all of a sudden we began to think about the fact that the rest of the world was catching up to the U.S. academically, and that we needed to focus more attention on the kind of core academic skills. So from around 1990 until probably the last few years, if you follow the U.S. at all, and there's some similarities, we've been focused on raising test scores with a huge amount of attention to the outcomes on standardized tests that were produced state by state, not even the same tests across the whole country. Like a lot of things we do in the United States, we tend to overdo good ideas, and we've certainly overdone that one. We've created a testing culture that is not very useful for teachers, since the accountability system focuses a huge amount of attention only on math and English achievement, so a lot of teachers' work is marginalized, and those who are in that system are really have what they teach and how they teach very much prescribed. Not a bad idea to have good basic skills, but to the exclusion of other things, not great. If there's any sort of silver lining from the fiscal crisis, I think it's focused considerable attention both on our high school, so what you would call upper secondary completion rates, and our post-secondary completion rates, which, despite all of the money, all of the effort, all of the political capital spent really haven't budged much in 30 or 40 years. So, I mean, there are high school completion rates have jumped up a little bit, but still, most young people are arriving in their in the U.S. in their mid-20s with really only about 30%, a little bit higher, get a bachelor's degree. Another 10% get a two-year degree, which we call the AA or Associate of Arts degree, and then some smaller percentage get a certificate. And people do go back to school, but still, a highly industrialized country with that poor a record is a bit of a problem. And I'm assuming are your data just about the same? Talk about
same part of town.
Yeah. So we began to look at the completion rates, and then we began to focus more attention on something that everybody has always known, which is that if school doesn't look relevant to you and you don't think you're going to get a job, you're more likely not to complete. And when you're in an economy that's very difficult, and given the costs of post-secondary education in our country, you don't want to go into debt, complete school or even start school and not complete with huge loans and not have it end up where you with you being able to pay back your loans and get on the path to a middle class life. So I think the fiscal crisis began to focus more attention on this, and we have had over the years we call a college for all kind of view about the world. And the college for all means to most people a bachelor's degree, so completion of high school and then 4 years of post-secondary. The reasons that has been the mantra in the U.S. are very complicated, but one of the most important ones is that we really have had a very fragmented and weak vocational education system, and it's the system in which, as we say, I heard a new acronym this morning, which I don't know, about ethnic and minority communities, but it's a system, we've had a system in which when you looked around, black and brown kids and poor kids were ending up in it, and it was a dead-end system. So we had a stigma attached to vocational education. And we also had this problem of civil rights around it, the civil rights community very strongly advocating for the bachelor's degree for all and for choices. Nonetheless, you know, like a lot of issues that are hot button issues and touch on really complicated issues of social cohesion, being silent is not very helpful. And so, I would say over the last 4 or 5 years, we've begun to ask ourselves, particularly as the labor market has changed and technical skills and middle skills jobs become part of the conversation and more attractive, at least in the education world, we've begun to say we can't just say everyone needs to get a bachelor's degree and we're afraid to have this conversation about technical skills because we might end up tracking black and brown kids into a dysfunctional system. Our perspective, and the perspective, oops, you've got the Pathways to Prosperity report. The perspective in that report is really that we need, for a wide range of students, regardless of their color or their economic status, a much wider range of options than a four-year college degree for everyone. I will say, and it's probably true here as well, there's a lot of confusion about what all of this means, because we have this sort of myth of college being the place where, in the U.S., we have liberal arts education. You don't necessarily pick your field of study initially, so you get this very broad, rich education. You read the great books, you learn about science, and then you do have some kind of a major or a field. We like to think that that's the dream, that everyone should have that. When you really look, the major of most post-secondary students in four-year degrees is business. So there's a real disjunction between this myth of the liberal arts degree that's going to train you for citizenship, open your mind, and what students are signaling by what they choose. So the Pathways to Prosperity report, drawing on nothing new by way of research, really pulling together research from multiple sources, argued that we need a much wider range of choices. We need a system for students who are not well suited to the four-year Bachelor of Arts degree for a whole variety of reasons. They're sick of sitting still, they don't want to be in school, just doing the same theoretical work. They really want to try out careers. They are from low-income families and want to be able to earn some money so that if they do decide to go on to a four-year degree, they have a trade or some kind of set of skills that they can sell in the marketplace. So this report has the name of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Harvard is sort of a magic word around the U.S. and probably in a lot of places, other places as well. Despite the fact this had three authors, one of them is not at Harvard at all. He's a former Businessweek reporter. One of them is an economist at the Kennedy School, happens to be African American and works on the achievement gap. And the third of them, to tell the truth, is my husband, who was a professor of public policy and not a researcher either. But somehow the Harvard name, the release of this report in Washington, D.C. with the Secretary of Education and a number of major business leaders caught the country's attention at a moment when attention was needed to these issues. And it argued we need a wider range of choices. We need pathways that link grades 9, 10, 11, and 12, which is high school, with at least 2 years of post-secondary. In our country, we call it community college. It's, in this country, it's the ninth grade. I would say it's 15 to 16-year-olds through 19 to 20-year-olds. So that middle adolescence period when you should be finding some work experience that sets you on a path to the future. So we began to think about how do we build such a system that integrates these grades, links to the labor market, and engages employers. And the report is just a report. Reports are wonderful. Sometimes they're very good at mobilizing people. The real work, of course, is doing things. And the report began to attract all of this attention, and Bill Simons, one of the authors, started going all around the country giving talks about the report and meeting with people. And states began to come to us and say, we would like to implement the Pathways to Prosperity ideas. And so we decided we would work with a number of states, and we invited some states to join us. I'm just trying to figure out what's useful for you to know, because there's some of you who are policy people and some of you who are working, it sounds like, pretty close to the ground with young people. And some of you are employers or interested in employers. So I'll kind of give you this. Okay, so I'll give you kind of a general outline of what we're doing, but I'll try and point out both the policy implications and the on-the-ground implications. It's a pretty messy story, and Anthony joined us. We brought all of the states together in early October, so this is very preliminary work, although many of these states already have pieces in place. Before I start talking about what we're doing, though, just I'll give you a very brief kind of overview of what we call vocational education in the U.S. When I was working at the OECD, we made them take the U.S. out of their data about career and about vocational education, because it's very mysterious how we count it, and it looks like we have no system whatsoever when you look at the OECD. We do. We have something called career and technical education, which is a new label pasted on top of vocational education to remove the stigma. But the way we count is that some proportion of young people take three courses in a career area while they're in high school, or in a specific career area, and some of them take three different courses in three different areas. That's what we consider career and technical education. We do have multiple kinds of institutions around the country. Some are high schools that have CTE programs so that you could be learning automotive or plumbing or IT by taking these kinds of courses. Some of them are separate schools. In Massachusetts, the state I come from, we have 26 regional vocational schools. They're actually very, very good. They have long waiting lists. They've gotten more popular. Students do go on to the workforce. Many also go on to community college and four-year degrees. So we have a wide range in the U.S., but it's not a system in the sense that any young people would say, I'm making a choice, as the good European systems do, between taking the academic track or taking the vocational track. So the states that came together with us have directors of career and technical education. Some of them link with the post-secondary system, and they do get some special federal funding for these programs. But they're generally not well aligned with the labor market. The community college curriculum is not well aligned with the high school curriculum. I don't know if any of this sounds familiar to you. And in general, the employer engagement is relatively weak. What we're trying to do is build a system and build a system that is broader than CTE. So I'm going to just give you a little bit of a... So the purpose of all of this, as all of you, I think, would share, is that we have very high youth unemployment here. That happens to be the United States, but the United Kingdom is, it goes China and then the United Kingdom. And this is just showing the rates of unemployment. There are other ways to look at this, but basically, way down at the end there, way down at that end, we'll see the countries that have very strong vocational systems, not just dual systems, but systems that are also school-based, but where there's major employer engagement. And so it's Switzerland, Netherlands, Austria, Japan, Norway. Mexico is something very peculiar there. We won't even ask. I think it has to do with the three students who are in vocational education being employed, and everyone else is in the under-the-table informal economy, but there it is. But all of those, Australia, have very strong vocational systems. So clearly, if you want to really support young people in a transition to work, you need to do something much more robust than our country or yours is doing, and not just for the students who are most at risk. So we... Is this not moving? Did we do something to this?
And we call James, and James fixed it for us.
If you go now, I'll keep this. Just in case.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So, this we know. So we created a very simple framework, which... you actually need a simple framework to do this, because as you begin to do the work on the ground, you need to be able to explain to people what are the levers that you're going to pull. So there are two building blocks. The first one, this brown circle, is these 9 to 14 pathways. And I'm going to go forward and then go back again. And this bottom circle here is employers hiring well-prepared young professionals. And we like the term young professionals. I got it from Switzerland, where those are the words they use at Swisscom, which is the biggest telecom and internet provider in the country, where they have 800 apprentices and they come in at age 15 and 16 and they're called young professionals. No one ever calls them students, no one ever calls them kids, or whatever the Schweizerdeutsche equivalent is. So just to say a word about the framework. This must look fairly familiar to you. We have very weak early advising in the U.S. Our high schools frequently have a ratio of one guidance counselor to 500 students, and that person is in charge of, you know, kids threatening suicide and preparing college applications for the state university system and Harvard or wherever else. So we have very weak guidance. We now have, and I'd be curious about your thoughts on this, we have lots of electronic products now, but I have a feeling that kids are kind of being plopped in front of computers and told, take this test, it'll tell you what you should do, bye-bye, no more conversation. And we also have the problem that parents, even well-educated parents, really don't know what the jobs look like for the future. So that's one of our levers. The second one is that our failure to really connect employers and schools, we believe, has been because we don't have sustained organizations that work between schools and employers. And for teachers and school heads to have the responsibility of knocking on doors and saying, you know, will you take this student into your company for 6 months? Simply, it's a kind of retail trade that will never get us the kind of mass participation that we need. So I don't know whether you use the term intermediary, but what I mean are the German chambers. In Switzerland, they're sectoral organizations. In the Netherlands, there's a whole governmental structure, the 17 or 18 centers that both run apprenticeship barometers, keep track quarterly of what the openings are. But these are, they're the translators and the facilitators of the linkage between schools and companies. They often execute contracts, they do assessments, they participate in curriculum. You have something called skills councils here, I believe.
We do. I mean, there's a number of organizations.
Yeah, but we have these things called workforce investment boards. They don't really do the job. I mean, you can look on an organization and chart, it's beautiful, but it's not beautiful in action. So then the third lever over here is employers engaged, I think we're offering our employers way too confusing a menu of things that they could do, and one of the things that we're trying to do with our work is figure out a sequence of employer-related activities that are well-designed and not confusing and that are tailored to the needs of sectors and companies. And then the 9 to 14 pathway, I think you have a bit more of that in this country, but our system stops at 18 and then you need to go on to post-secondary. And 18 is not compulsory in all states, but it's by and large the end of compulsory. So we have a huge dropout rate before 18 and then a lot of students who, as you say here in the subway, they don't mind the gap. They fall right into it, and they never go on to get a post-secondary credential. And we have had a very strong view in our country that the post-secondary is where you do your career training, not really in high school. So for those of you working on the ground directly, it might be useful to know that over the last 10, 12 years, my organization, which is about 100 people working around the country and funded by government contracts and also largely by private foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've created a new model of school which actually combines 2 years of post-secondary education with high school so that students are assured that they are going to be linked to a post-secondary education the moment they enter either seventh grade or ninth grade. And the reason for doing that is, one, to motivate underprepared students from low-income families with the notion that they won't have to apply to college and they'll have free college courses, and we will accelerate them. We'll make them, instead of doing the same thing over and over again, remediating them, we'll challenge them, move them forward quickly. And now we have about 300 of these schools in 28 states or so. And a larger kind of initiative in the U.S. to make these kinds of linkages. And those students, are about a quarter of them are graduating with an associate's degree, which is a good thing. And the average with about a year of post-secondary credit, so that it's a way of both reserving places in a higher ed institution and ensuring that young people who might not go on are don't have to face this gap. The gap is already, the school, the two sets of schools are already integrated. So this is, I'm going to just say a little bit about this quickly because it probably doesn't mean so much to you. But these are the states that have joined the initiative. And what was interesting was the way in which states came to us with different sources. But we believe if you're going to do this work, and in some ways this is the kind of work that the Education and Employer Task Force is doing, you need visible, high-level stakeholders, in this case governors, heads of state chambers, who are willing to really be the champions of building these kinds of pathways and who are the champions of young people. Commissioner of Education, if you don't know, our language in the state is the lead education officer. Secretary of Education is a similar kind of role. You'll notice a number of these states, and Georgia has now joined, are southern states. And those are states which in many ways have kept the vocational tradition, but they haven't modernized it. And those are places where we need to change the current curriculum. So we're working across large metropolitan areas like Chicago, which has about 2 million students. San Bernardino and Riverside, I'm just writing a report about that, which is, it's over 122,000 square miles, just San Bernardino, and there are about 5 million people, and it's the poorest area in the United States. It's had a major meltdown of construction industry. And then some smaller areas and some rural ones. What was interesting is we spent the summer going to various regions in each of these states and trying to find out what are the growth sectors. My organization generates what we call real-time labor market information, at which we cross-hatch with the Bureau of Labor Statistics data and various other kinds of data. But when these kinds of areas came up, these are all what I would call modern, new kinds of careers. We can look at the labor market and say this many people have been hired with these kinds of skills. These are the numbers of openings. Using, do you know monster.com? These are these enormous bulletin boards. We can look at data for 50 million jobs and be able to tell you in real time what the openings are. So these are the career areas that have emerged. And I would say our schools are not well prepared to teach these. And I'd be curious about whether yours are. Particularly the top three, IT just crosses everything. And there are many areas in IT, as you probably well know. I mean, there's one pathway if you're going to be a computer scientist, and another if you're going to be a support person, and another if you're going to do programming. Our schools are woefully unaware of those pathways, have relatively little curriculum, and they are relatively misaligned with our post-secondary system. And so we've begun particularly to focus our attention there, working backward from the labor market to what ninth graders ought to be doing in the IT sector. The rest of these we could talk about, but they all require IT. They require also what we call STEM skills. I don't know if you use that term here, and they require fairly substantial capacity in mathematics in general. So what we're on the stigma issue, I'm tending to say that STEM and CTE have a share a T, which is technological skills, technology, high tech. and that this is not just, this is not for dumb kids, this is not for the kids who are only our at-risk kids, this is for everyone, it's demanding. This is one way of trying to deal with this issue of the stigma around career and technical education. I just said a word about these. So these states will be focusing on these pathways and will begin to build aligned curriculum. One thing I should say, though, is when we talk about pathways, we're not talking just about the career pathway. I think one of the things that you've had a problem with in this country, and we certainly have had too, is that vocational education has been perceived as very narrow and really at the service of specific companies' needs. And one of the things to me that's been very attractive in the work I've done on the European systems is to see that there's a commitment among employers as well as social partners to maintain the breadth of the system, and particularly the ability to learn how to learn. Just say a quick word about the breadth issue. I just came from Finland. All of you probably know the Finland miracle with PISA. So I got so tired of hearing about how wonderful 15-year-olds that, without having any idea what happened after 15. So I decided I would go and take a look at their VET system, and that's now serving about 50% of students and growing pretty quickly. It's actually a bit more now than 50%. One of the interesting things that I heard in all of the schools that I visited was that a very important part of what they're teaching in VET is for students to be entrepreneurs. Whether they're working in a company, a big company, or whether they're starting a company themselves. And I think it's an interesting way to think about this breadth issue, because their view, and I was surprised, they don't have intermediary organizations, but one of the ways that they teach students, and I think this is relatively new, is that part of what they learn is to be the entrepreneur at 16 or 18 who goes out to find a work placement. And the process of doing the research, finding the placement, students are doing 20 applications in many cases, is part of learning to be an entrepreneur, which is to know your own skills, advocate for yourself, and be an active participant in creating your own future. But I also think, and that economists say this in a nice way, that employers need to understand that the young person should own their own skills and be able to sell them in the marketplace. In other words, they should be broad enough so that they're transferable. There's a certain point at which you bring your skills in a specific area, but the company puts the finishing touches on it for their particular needs, or at least that's the way I think about the public investment, which is into the labor market, into a sector, but not into, you need to do it exactly this way because you're in my company. So I'm going to, I see time is going quickly here, so I'm going to just zoom through this. The asset mapping that we did this summer in all of these, in all of the states, yielded a lot of observations about what was going on. Some of this may ring true to you. I'm just going to look at one or two of these. So the issue of there's a miscommunication year after year between employers and educators. Employers don't want to be in the business of improving schools, and school people don't understand the business environment. So being very specific and having a good communication is really important. So this is about having intermediaries. Career advising we've talked about, but time and time again we heard this issue of parents need to be part of this and they don't know. Teachers doing externships, very, very important, because teachers themselves don't know about the workplace. Having just come from Finland, there the teachers' schedules are such that when their students are in workplaces, they are back and forth in the workplaces as well, and that helps them keep their skills up to date. We talked about this morning, there are alignment issues. but also that because of the fiscal crisis, many adults are coming back to school with lots of experience and lots of motivation, and they're pushing out or preventing young people from taking those places. So there's a real capacity issue, at least in the States, that we need to pay attention to. So I think I'm going to skip this. This is much more U.S.-centered, except that I think every country, even with very good systems, does have this issue of combating the stigma. One of the ways we're doing it is really by looking at the earnings outcomes for middle-skilled jobs. Now in the U.S., I was just comparing entry-level wages with a humanities degree from a four-year institution versus someone with technical skills from a two-year. It's about 10 to 15% higher at the entry level if you get a job with your four-year degree. And that's something that I think parents and kids understand. So getting these modern careers with high technical skills, you can sell as a good way of being able to enter, at least get a good entry-level job and have the possibility of earning what we call a family-supporting wage. This is all about legislation, which we can talk about. We have many new things going on in the U.S., and some of it, I think, will be very, very important in supporting this kind of 9 through 14 pathways linked to careers. I will say one final thing, which is really kind of interesting, is a number of Swiss and German and Austrian companies have now moved big plants to the U.S., part of a reshoring process. Very interesting. Volkswagen just built a plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They're hiring 3,000 people. It's such a spectacular plant that you have to make an appointment 3 weeks in advance to even get a tour. And they are with a kind of a community college, a new science high school, and a technical adult technical skills center. This is the only place outside of the only place where they're doing training outside of their own company. And these are small experiments, but they're pretty powerful to see how the German, Swiss, Austrian apprenticeship system is being adapted to the U.S. And particularly around this advanced manufacturing, we're finding the need there is so high that employers are very willing to jump in. They don't have welders, they don't have people who can make these incredibly expensive one-off machines, and parents and kids still think it's dirty, dangerous work. And I was in a factory in Helsinki the other day where it was silent and clean, and the person in the manufacturing person was sitting in front of a computer. So there we are. This is a little bit about my organization. So why don't I stop there? And I'm sort of keeping an eye on all of you. I can't tell how much of this is so U.S.-centric that you were all tuned out, or you were thinking, oh my God, that's even worse than the UK. What would be interesting for you to comments, questions?
Yep.